From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Lee Kuan Yew, founder of Modern Singapore, dies at 91. India and China hold border talks. The Afghan president is expected to urge flexibility in U.S. troop withdrawals, plus conservatives win France's local elections. I'm Frances Alonso. Former Singapore Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew died early today. He was 91 years old. Ron Corbin looks back on Lee's life and career.
Harry Lee Kuan Yew, a fourth-generation Singaporean whose ancestors migrated from China's Guangdong province in the 1860s, played a primary role in guiding the island state's post-colonial era toward economic success. A survivor of the Japanese Imperial Army's occupation of Singapore, Lee studied economics in London after the war and attended Cambridge University, gaining a law degree. His political life began in 1954 with the formation of the People's Action Party, PAP, a coalition of middle-class and pro-communist trade unionists. In 1955, Lee was the opposition leader in the legislature. But splits within the PAP with the party's left wing led to arrests of pro-communists in 1957. The PAP won an electoral landslide in 1959, and Lee Kuan Yew became Singapore's first Prime Minister, a position he held until 1990 before taking a post of Senior Minister. Carl Thayer, a political scientist at the University of New South Wales in Australia, says Lee was pivotal to Singapore's long-term future.
The story of modern-day Singapore can't be told without reference to Lee Kuan Yew. He took the country from colonial rule to independence. He fended off challenges by the socialist left, and then he dominated politics.
Lee faced political challenges as prime minister. An early goal was the formation of a federation of Malaysia, bringing together Singapore, Malaya, Sabah and Sarawak. But differences soon emerged between Peninsular Malaysia's prime minister, Tunku Abdul Rahman, and Lee, especially after race riots between Chinese and Muslims in 1964 and again in 1965. And on August 9, 1965, Abdul Rahman called for separation. At the age of 42, Lee became Singapore's sole leader, driving hard on economic growth to build the republic and to foster unity.
I am not here to play somebody else's game. I have a few million people's lives to account for. Singapore will survive.
Analysts say Lee's strengths lay in setting standards and objectives, a strategic thinker promoting Singapore's most valuable resource, its people. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
India and China began an 18th round of border talks in New Delhi Monday in an effort to resolve a long-standing territorial dispute. The talks about the line of actual control are the first since Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi came into office last year. The two countries have long been embroiled in the bitter territorial dispute. Small incursions occur frequently across the line of actual control, the de facto border that runs 4,000 kilometers across the Himalayas and involves large swaths of remote territory. Korean activists has postponed for a few days at least a planned launch of balloons carrying DVDs of the movie The Interview into North Korea. Pyongyang recently threatened to shoot down the balloons and advised South Koreans living near the border to evacuate for their own safety. VOA's Brian Patton reports from Seoul.
The activists are backing down for the moment on plans to launch balloons carrying copies of the controversial comedy movie The Interview about a fictional CIA plot to assassinate North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and some 500,000 propaganda leaflets across the border. Park Sang-hak, the head of the Fighters for Free North Korea group that organizes the balloon launches, told VOA the decision to postpone was made in reaction to Pyongyang's threat to use its frontline military units to shoot down the balloons. He says North Korea made an empty threat through their television, saying that our launch of leaflets is an act of war and a declaration of war, and asked our residents to evacuate. When he heard it, he said he decided not to send leaflets. but Park said this postponement is contingent upon North Korea apologizing for its role in sinking the South Korean warship Cheonan and killing 46 sailors. Pyongyang has denied any involvement in the torpedo attack that occurred 5 years ago this week.
혹시 사과할 수 있으니까 이번에
Park says there is a possibility that North Korea may apologize as it will be the fifth anniversary. So they will wait for North Korea's apology, he says, and if Pyongyang apologizes, then they will not send leaflets. The postponement and demand for an apology seem unlikely to ease tensions on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea has called these leaflet campaigns acts of war and demanded that they be stopped before any inter-Korean cooperation talks can resume. Last October, there was a brief exchange of heavy machine gunfire across the border during a balloon launching by the activists. Some South Korean residents living near the border have expressed concern that the balloon launches could prompt North Korea to attack their towns and villages. Seoul says it will respond if attacked over the balloon launches. But Lim Byung-chul, the Unification Ministry spokesman, says the government will not restrain the anti-Pyongyang activists.
민간단체의 대북전단 살포는 기본권인 표현의 자유의 영역으로서
He says that the leaflet launch by private groups is the domain of freedom of expression, which is a basic right, so it cannot be forcibly regulated and depends on the decision of the private parties. The Unification Ministry spokesman did say, however, that if the launch poses a danger to people living in the border area, the government would intercede in a measured way. Last year, the U.S. accused North Korea of a cyber attack on a U.S. movie studio to prevent the release of the interview and, in response, imposed new sanctions on the Kim Jong-un government. Pyongyang denied any involvement in the attack and called the movie an act of war. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
The governor of the southern Japanese island of Okinawa has ordered a suspension to all work at the site where a key U.S. military base is to be relocated. Governor Takeshi Onaga said Monday that a concrete block thrown into the sea for a drilling survey had damaged a coral reef. In Tokyo, the chief cabinet secretary, Yoshihide Suga, told a news conference that it's not possible that the work be suspended because it's taking place after Okinawa already agreed to it. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah are visiting Washington this week. They're expected to urge the Obama administration to allow some flexibility in the pace of U.S. troop withdrawals. VOA's Victor Beatty reports that the visit of Afghanistan's top leaders comes as the White House says extremist elements operating in Afghanistan continue to pose a threat to U.S. national interests.
Mr. Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah will meet Monday with Defense Secretary Ashton Carter at the Pentagon. Later, they will hold talks with three U.S. cabinet secretaries and other national security officials. Tuesday, the Afghan leaders meet with President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden and visit Arlington National Cemetery, where many U.S. Afghan veterans are buried. Wednesday, Mr. Ghani will address a joint meeting of Congress. Thursday, the Afghan leaders head to New York and meetings with UN officials. Before leaving Kabul, the Afghan leader said he's aware of the sensitivity in the U.S. of slowing the pace of the withdrawal of U.S. troops, currently at 9,800, after more than 13 years of conflict.
Issue of numbers is a very complicated domestic issue in the United States we don't want to get into. We will explain the condition, what we are doing, how we are bringing those efficiencies, and then we need to let the internal process take over and arrive at decisions that serves both our need, the region's, the global needs, and the security of the United States.
In a broadcast interview aired Sunday, Mr. Ghani warned the threats from extremists Afghanistan faces every day were they to overwhelm Afghan efforts to confront them would threaten the world at large. Now that the NATO-U.S. combat mission is over, the Obama administration has planned to reduce the current U.S. troop level down to 5,500 by year's end, and even less by the time Mr. Obama leaves office in early 2017. Friday, White House spokesman Josh Earnest said Mr. Obama is hearing from his national security team and commanders on the ground about the proper way to manage the pace of the drawdown and the proper way to sequence base closures.
And I think it's common sense that we would make these decisions about our troop presence relative to the security situation. And the United States is no longer responsible for the security situation in Afghanistan. But the United States is interested in making sure that we have a troop presence that can protect our forces that are on the ground. We want to make sure that we can continue to have some counterterrorism capability in Afghanistan, because there are still extremist elements operating in Afghanistan that do pose a threat to our interests.
The commander of NATO forces in Afghanistan, U.S. Army General John Campbell, recently told U.S. lawmakers he wants to get through a full fighting season in the new mission to train, advise, and assist Afghan security forces. He says downsizing to 5,500 could divert attention away from that mission, and that's why flexibility is important. As for the presence of the Islamic State Group, or Daesh, in Afghanistan, Campbell said they do not necessarily represent new fighters.
Thus far, we believe that the Daesh presence in Afghanistan represents more of a rebranding of some of the marginalized Taliban. But we're still taking this potential threat with its dangerous rhetoric and ideology very, very seriously.
RAND Corporation South Asia analyst Jonah Blank says it is understandable the administration is considering altering its troop withdrawal timetable.
That is very largely the result of the election of Ashraf Ghani, who is seen as a much more reliable partner than Hamid Karzai. And second, the success of ISIL, or Daesh, as it's also called, in Iraq and Syria.
Blank says the view of some within the Obama administration is that they do not want a repeat of the IS group's large presence in Iraq after U.S. forces withdrew to be repeated in Afghanistan. Afghan analyst Nawaz Sharani of Indiana University says Mr. Ghani will also be seeking economic assistance for an economy that has weakened with a diminished foreign presence.
The economy of Afghanistan in the last 13 years has been growing for the most part, but this year, last year that is, it has been reported to be the worst year of economic condition in the country. People are more or less up in arms right now. They were hoping, in fact, he had promised that 6 months after he takes oath of office that there will be improvement in the dining tables of all Afghans. And of course, there is no improvement, but things have gotten worse.
Sharani says the political uncertainty, with only a fraction of cabinet posts filled, has created a poor investment climate in Afghanistan. He says many young Afghans are unemployed. Sharani says Mr. Ghani may also seek U.S. support for international efforts to engage the Taliban in possible peace talks. As for what the U.S. side may seek, the Indiana University academician expects Washington to encourage the Afghan leader to complete his cabinet, institute electoral reform, fight corruption, and promote good governance. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, on Sunday urged all of the rival parties in Yemen to return to the U.N.-mediated peace talks after Shiite Houthi rebels seized the central city of Taiz. Power issued a statement following an emergency U.N. Security Council meeting to discuss the situation in Yemen. She said the Houthis' actions have consistently undermined Yemen's transition and that the council reaffirmed its support for President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi. The first members of a potential unity government in Libya could be named in the coming days. That's according to the UN's envoy to Libya. There is a chance that we can make progress and have the first names for a unity government this week. That's according to envoy Bernardino León, who spoke to reporters Monday in Brussels. He cautioned not to set expectations too high, given the difficult situation on the ground in Libya. As countries mark World TB Day, the World Health Organization is rolling out a new strategy to end the global tuberculosis epidemic. The WHO is calling for worldwide support to wipe out this ancient scourge over the next 20 years. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Two previous strategies have cleared the way for this latest and most ambitious plan. WHO is convinced its current strategy, called NTB, has a good chance of working because of the success of the .TB treatment and the Stop TB strategies that were rolled out earlier this century. Tremendous progress has been made in the fight against TB in recent years. Between 2000 and 2013, an estimated 37 million lives have been saved through TB TB diagnosis and treatment. But the World Health Organization says much more needs to be done to combat this deadly disease. Director of the WHO Global TB Program, Mario Raviglione, says the End TB Strategy represents a historic opportunity to wipe out an epidemic that has been the cause of death, illness, and suffering for millennia.
Let us remember that TB affected 9 million people in 2013, killed 1.5 million people, including 360,000 people living with HIV, and also 500,000 multidrug-resistant TB cases emerged in the same year, causing, of course, alarm and concern everywhere in the world, as these are difficult cases to manage and have a very high case fatality rate.
Tuberculosis is a contagious airborne disease. It is the second leading cause of death from a single infectious agent after HIV. More than 95% of cases and deaths are in developing countries. Tuberculosis is curable and preventable, and WHO is counting on this fact to push forward its ambitious new strategy, which calls for a 95% reduction in TB deaths and a 90% reduction in cases of TB by 2035. A key milestone to be reached in the next 5 years is the elimination of catastrophic costs for TB patients and their families. Tuberculosis can bankrupt families due to the direct medical costs and the loss of income linked to the six-month period of treatment. WHO says medical costs and loss of income can be offset through the establishment of various financial protection schemes, including universal health coverage. The strategy calls for bold policies by governments to support TB programs and emphasizes the need for new tools, intensified research, and innovation. Dr. Raviglione tells VOA there is movement in this direction, with new diagnostics and drugs coming down the pipeline.
We need rapid, right, molecular possibly, and genetic-based drug susceptibility testing. That's what we're after. Something that is simple and can be done at the most peripheral place as quickly as possible. And we are not far from that technology to possibly become true.
WHO reports the global cure rate for multidrug-resistant TB is 48% compared to an 86% cure rate for normal TB. Dr. Raviglione says two new drugs have been approved, which have the potential to increase the cure rate for both multidrug and extensively drug-resistant TB. But he notes problems of access and availability of these drugs still must be worked out. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
France's conservative UMP party, led by former President Nicolas Sarkozy, placed first in Sunday's local elections. President François Hollande's Socialist Party did not expect to win, but had encouraged French citizens to come out to vote against Marine Le Pen's far-right National Front, also known as the FN Party. Initial projections gave UMP 31% of the vote, with FN receiving 24%. The ruling Socialists trailed with 19%. The UMP and the Socialists will be able to call on allies when voters go to the polls in next Sunday's runoff elections. Analysts say UMP and Socialist voters will likely switch allegiance in the runoff to whatever party will keep FN out of office. Political observers say the FN, with its anti-immigration, anti-Islam, and anti-Euro platform, will be hard-pressed to find allies. The leader of debt-ridden Greece meets Monday with the leader of economic powerhouse Germany. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras warned the German Chancellor Angela Merkel ahead of their meeting Monday that his country will not be able to pay its debt without the help from the European Union. That's according to a report in Monday's Financial Times. The Times says it has acquired a copy of a letter dated March 15th in which Mr. Tsipras warns that his government will be forced to choose between paying off loans owned primarily to the International Monetary Fund or continue social spending. Tsipras wrote, "I am urging you not to allow a small cash flow issue and a certain institutional inertia to not turn to a large problem for Greece and for Europe." Chancellor Angela Merkel wants her Greek counterpart to make and enforce tough spending cuts and reforms in order to receive more bailout money, the biggest share of which is financed by Germany. Pakistan held its first Republic Day parade on Monday after a gap of 7 years to underscore its improved security around the country following recent military-led counterterrorism operations. Security was extremely tight in Islamabad, particularly around the venue where aerial military expertise was demonstrated as fighter planes and helicopters flew over the capital city. Among other military weapons and equipment, the country also demonstrated its first locally manufactured armed drone aircraft. The U.S. has used drone strikes to attack al-Qaeda operatives sheltering in Pakistan and tribal areas near the Afghan border. Opposition lawmakers in Sierra Leone are challenging President Ernest Bai Koroma's move to fire his vice president, calling it a fundamental breach of the country's constitution. Thank you for joining us for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 23, 1743, George Friedrich Handel's oratorio Messiah had its London premiere. King George II was so moved by the Alleluia chorus, he rose to his feet. The entire audience followed suit out of respect for the king, and so began the custom of standing during the singing of the Alleluia chorus. On this day in 1775, in a speech before the Virginia House of Burgesses, American lawyer Patrick Henry spoke about what North American colonists saw as the increasingly oppressive British rule over them. In a ringing endorsement of revolution against Britain, Henry declared, "Give me liberty or give me death." In 1801, Tsar Paul I of Russia was murdered by disgruntled nobles. Paul was struck with a sword, strangled, and finally trampled to death inside his bedroom at St. Michael's Castle. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world is changing, and so is diplomacy and development. Global challenges such as climate change, poverty, terrorism, and disease are often too expansive and complex to be met by any one government or group. Addressing such problems requires innovation, ingenuity, and collaboration across diverse sectors. In 2009, the Secretary's Office of Global Partnerships was established at the U.S. State Department to promote the development of public-private partnerships to leverage the best of public and private sector resources to create practical solutions for such challenges. The office, which has leveraged over $829 million in public and private resources since 2009, engages companies, startups, NGOs, foundations, faith-based organizations, universities, research centers, and civil society groups as full partners in the process of problem-solving. In Africa, the three-year-old Liberalizing Innovation Opportunity Nations Partnership, or Lions at Africa, mobilizes the knowledge, expertise, and resources of leading public and private institutions to encourage and enhance technology and innovation by investing in capacity building for startups, providing access to capital, promoting connectivity with global markets, and raising the credibility of the startup culture. Some 2,000 entrepreneurs have participated in Lions at Africa-supported capacity-building activities. Over 80 startups were launched at Demo Africa, a signature annual event, and raised more than $10 million in capital financing to date. In 2013, five Lions innovators won opportunities to present their ideas at the main demo event in the United States High-Tech Center, Silicon Valley. Over 30 Lions won opportunities to compete in South Africa at a global pitch event for leading international investors. And 80 children are participating in pilot Africoder Dojo programs in Nigeria and Tanzania that provide free computer coding sessions and mentoring to young people. Many more coding clubs are planned across the continent. As with our nation's public-private partnership efforts in other parts of the world, Lions at Africa leverages the financial and in-kind resources of both the public and private sectors. It brings together leading IT companies, international development organizations, technology associations, and startup accelerators and incubators across the African continent to develop flagship programs and initiatives that deliver widespread results.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.